Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Store. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's His U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever heard, frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
And I noticed I put up a post on something recently. Oh, yeah, it was a picture of my new pod. And in one of the comments underneath, someone just wrote, "Hello, Gary. Hello, Guy."
Did they?
Yeah, so it's a trademark, why I have to go first every time.
That's what we do. So we have the Poet Laureate of the United Kingdom on our show today.
We're upping our game.
Yeah.
But what's so nice, Gary, is we're at an age where we now have a Poet Laureate who doesn't come from some sort of unimaginable ivory tower sort of netherworld of literary fancy. He's someone who grew up with the Smiths, comes from the same place as all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're wondering why he's on, he's got a band. They've just released their second album. He recites lyrics in them, poetry lyrics. He talks with the music and it's absolutely amazing. Now, I have got a little bit of trouble because we're going to have to ask him because the band is LYR Land Yacht Regatta.
Regatta.
How do you pronounce it? Do I say liar?
Liar. When I first saw it, I didn't realise it stood for Land Yacht Regatta. And you just assume he's a poet, he's northern, that it's a liar. I was thinking medieval.
The liar, yeah.
Even though that has an E. And his partner in that is, in fact, someone who's worked extensively with Bernard Butler.
Yeah, there you go. You're talking about Richard Walters.
I am.
Okay, so, but also, you know, he's dabbled in music for a bit. You know, he worked with a guy called Craig Smith on The Scaremongers back in 2009. He's had 20 collections of poetry out. He's written librettos. He's written a novel. He's written plays. But he also wrote this fantastic autobiography, that's easy for you to say, called Gig, which was about him wanting to be a rock star when he was a younger man, which I fascinated to talk to him about.
Well, yes. Oh, my God, I've just realised that I have my mic turned on. I've basically everything we've just said written down in a sort of garbled version as a text message.
Does it make poetic sense? Is it in a stanza or is it a sonnet?
Yeah, it's broken down into iambic pentameter.
Oh my God. Let's get the expert on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Ah! are you in Marsden, Simon? Hello, I'm Guy. Sorry.
Hey.
Hi, Guy. Yeah, and hi, Gary. Nice to meet you both. We live just outside a little town called Home Firth.
Oh, yes.
Have you ever seen a show called Last of the Summer
Wine? I think they want to compare to it a lot. All the bands we play for are always getting compared to Last of the Summer Wine. That's where we are now.
Yeah.
Do they ask you to go down a hillside in a shopping trolley or yeah, so I think they've stopped filming it now, actually. But yeah, it's a lovely little town up in the Pennines, and we live up on the hills, quite remote actually, just on the edge of Saddleworth Moor. So between Leeds and Manchester on the map,
Snake Pass.
Snake Pass is the. It's the sometimes thought of as the drug running pass between Sheffield and Manchester. It's always closed, either because of snow or accident or landslide, but it's quite notorious.
So it's like the North Silk Road.
Yeah, exactly.
Where all the opium travelled.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, yeah.
But I thought you might be in your shed. Is that shed real? Do you have that, your working space? Because you do your podcast from your shed.
Yeah, it's absolutely real. I think some people, when they turn up to be on the programme, think it's a conceit. You know, there's going to be an outside broadcasting van parked in the on the lawn. But it's an actual shed. And, there's me and a lawnmower, basically. And I think that's what encourages. So, you know, the conversation's very intimate because, you know, there's nowhere else to go and there's none of the paraphernalia of a studio. It's been great fun, that series. It only started really as a back of an envelope job, and then the next thing, Johnny Marr's turning up with his guitar.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't heard that one.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
you'd have liked that one. And the kid in you must have been, Simon, must have been in awe of having this guy walking in, because I know you were a massive Smiths fan back in the 80s.
Yeah, it was a huge moment for me. I wasn't actually sure that he was going to turn up. It had been a fairly loose arrangement. And so he was just hanging around in the yard. And he came around the corner and jumped out, said hello. I mean, you know him. He's a lovely guy. But the great thing was he went into the passenger seat and pulled out his guitar. And I think he uses it as a bit of a prop and a prompt when he's talking. And so he sort of nursed it in his lap all the way through the interview. And then there was this incredible moment where he was talking about something and almost subconsciously he started playing Suffer Little Children, you know, from the first Smiths album. And
the first song they ever wrote.
Is that right? Yeah. I didn't know that. And I was looking at him in the shed, I was looking at the profile of his head. And I suddenly realised that the horizon of Saddleworth Moor, which is, you know, where that song is set, was running through his ears.
Wow.
Yeah.
The thing is with Johnny is he carries rock and roll with him everywhere, because people in Saddleworth Moor and where you live don't have that hair every day, right? That's rock hair, isn't it?
It's rock hair, yeah, and it never seems out of place or anything other than rock hair.
I know my I remember once being at an Ivan Novello Awards, and my friend said to me, he said, look around this room and you can tell when everyone had their biggest hit because that's the haircut from that period they still have.
I was at a sort of rock and roll event once somewhere in London, and I was sitting behind Bono and Simon Le Bon. And I think I made that connection there, that I could tell from their hair profiles what their biggest hits were.
You've won an Ivan Novello as well, haven't you?
Thank you for mentioning that, Gary.
I was very surprised to read that.
Yeah, it was a great moment. I worked on a film called Feltham Sings, where we went into Feltham Young Offenders Unit and I wrote song lyrics for the lads in there. They told me about their personal histories and their circumstances. And I worked with a musician called Dextrous. He wrote the music. And it became a bit of a cult documentary. We gained access because there'd been a terrible racist murder at Feltham the year before. And I think they were looking to bring people in and slightly, you know, change the image of what the prison was. It is an extraordinary place. There are all the wings are named after different birds, and there are peacocks strutting around the prison as well. So there was plenty of imagery to work with. I sometimes, when I see Paul McCartney being interviewed, and there's one of those figurines behind him from the Ivor Novello Awards on his mantelpiece there, I sometimes have a little quiet moment thinking, you know, I've got one of them, Paul.
But talking about that, going into that Feltham Institute, is this a thing of because I don't want to talk about you being poet laureate, which is, you know, amazing what that means, but do you find that you have incredible access to sort of, because of that, you can go anywhere?
That's a really interesting question. I've noticed that access has come through just being a poet generally. I've noticed it at international checkpoints. You know, you get up to the front of the immigration queue and they say, what do you do? And you say, I'm a poet. And I think it's just too weird to argue with. It's just sort of wave you through. And because I used to be a probation officer in Manchester, and I gave that up to become a poet. And I suppose I imagined then that it really would be, you know, me sitting in a back bedroom writing and scribbling and scratching. But it has become this sort of passport or this invitation into other worlds and other environments and different projects. So it's, you know, I mean, there are strong connections with the music world, so perhaps that's more easily anticipated. But yeah, I think every now and again, poetry just makes the gates open, or it makes the border guards stand to one side.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, it is an armory, isn't it? It's a weaponry, that words, and they can be quite intimidating. But it's also what diplomats use. So there's an international quality about being a poet.
Yeah, I think poetry, you know, permeates a lot of language, from political speeches through to adverts. Essentially, it's a language of persuasion. You're trying to get people to accept and believe what you're saying, and sometimes it's misused in those settings as well. But yeah, I've always maintained that it's a very powerful force. You know, it's I think of language as the most powerful force in the universe, stronger than gravity or nuclear fission. But you know, you can get people to do almost anything if you put language in the right way, whether it's persuasion or... But you're right, Gary. Yeah, it can be sharp-edged as well.
I mean, it turns that saying on its head, doesn't it? Sticks and stones, you know, and names will never hurt me. Because actually, nowadays, we're living in a period where name-calling hurts most of all.
Yeah, exactly. And I was watching something on TV last night. There's a big campaign to try and, you know, nullify the negative effects of social media. And I think it's been fronted by self-esteem. And that's exactly the point, that this is all through language that really gets into people's souls and bothers them and upsets them when it's used in the wrong way. Well, we've got to quite a dark place very quickly, haven't we?
I wanted to make a point about, not so dark, but on the general power of language, as if you think of when it's taken away. Like, you can go to somewhere in Europe and meet someone who is from, say, professionally, socio-culturally, economically, exactly the same place as you, where you have so much in common and you would be, there's a great friendship waiting to happen, but you don't speak their language and everything is stripped away.
Yeah, it's incredibly nuanced language. I was talking to somebody the other day, somebody who was just embarking on a new sort of romantic life, and they were on a dating app, and I was saying, do you actually talk to people before you go and meet them? And she was saying, no, it's just text. And I was saying, I would find that very frustrating, because it's not just the language that you use, but the way that you use it, which implies so much about your personality and your character. But yeah, very powerful force.
You said that poetry was an art form of absence. It sounds great.
Yeah.
Just expand on it, though.
Yeah. I wonder if I might have said at some point as well that it's an art form of absinthe. yeah, I think I was probably talking about what's left out of a poem, you know, the things it doesn't say. So, it tends to be the art form of less is more. And you can see that just by looking at a poem on the page. You know, it rarely reaches the bottom of the page. It's shy of the right-hand margin on the page. There's a lot of space there, and that space is the invitation for your imagination to do the rest of the work. And I think we're quite scared of silence and absence. You know, silence is very dangerous in music. It's very challenging to a listener. How long you might dare leave a drop out.
It's also very exciting.
Yeah, really exciting, because it's kind of dangerous and it's full of wonder and anticipation. I know they don't like it on radio because they're worried that people will think the channel's, you know, imploded or something. But yeah, I think I've described poetry before, and maybe a little pretentiously, as language in zero gravity. I'm just trying to set up that idea that it doesn't really need the usual support systems that come around prose and other forms of writing. It can just sort of float there on its own and be suggestive rather than, you know, informative.
That actually feeds into something I did want to ask you about, which is the difference between poetry and lyrics. Because I watched something last night, which was brilliant, which is a clip of you and Paul Morley, and you're dissecting This Charming Man by the Smiths. And it's obviously a song that you know very, very well, because you drill down to the absolute heart of every line, just like that, right to the heart in a way. And I was thinking, because you're talking about sort of suggestion and meaning, but I actually would say that with lyrics, there's a luxury you don't have as a poet, which is that with lyrics, you can be more opaque and obtuse because you have the cover of music. Whereas with you, your words on the page, that's it. That's everything that's happening. So you have to come away with what that gives you. You can't go, oh, it kind of means like this, because there's this gorgeous Johnny Marr world happening anyway.
But also to sort of add to that a little bit, you know, with poetry, there's an absolute distillation of ideas. And in a way, the imagination that the reader adds is like water that's going to bring this thing up to what it should be. And music becomes that imagination with lyrics in a way, doesn't it? It enhances the distillation of the words.
I would absolutely agree with all that. And actually, just thinking about that interview with Paul Morley, I think in the same programme, I talked to Mick Joyce about the lyrics for This Charming Man.
I saw Mick sitting, and he's just sitting there looking a bit, and I'm thinking, oh,
well, it's me talking about it. Me talking about the sort of homoerotic qualities of the language and everything, and he just looked back at me and said, I just thought it was a good riff. But yeah, that's right. So in a poem, I mean, if it's a poem, you know, if it's text, if it's on the page, all the orchestration, all the composition, all the signposting and signalling and the gesturing, that all has to come through these little, you know, usually black shapes on a white background. I'm not there to nursemaid these things or to, you know, tell people what the implications are. But with a song, the lyric is just a component part of, you know, something much bigger and much more complex, and I think something more mysterious as well. I think when you're writing a lyric, and I know this from practice, you can do things which on paper might look strange or mundane, but when they come with the, you know, suddenly the a chord structure can make the most ordinary lyric transcendent. I sometimes give the example of, there's a U2 song, I think it's called Who's Gonna Ride Your White Horses. Mm-hmm. And there's a line in that song where Bono sings, hey now shalala, hey now shalala. Well, you couldn't really do that in a poem and get away with it. It would look very odd on the page. But in that track, something quite extraordinary happens in that little change of emphasis. But it's to do with performance, delivery, chord change. And, yeah, this thing called music, which is doing a lot of the heavy lifting sometimes and supplying the, you know, the emotions that the lyrics don't always need to give it.
Yeah, because also I think, for instance, repetition in poetry is a very, very different thing.
Well,
to repetition in a lyric,
it is, but it sometimes harks back to sort of ballads. You know, a lot of ballads you can only read now because we don't know what the music is. You know, you know, something like The Highwayman, and the highwayman comes riding, 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 and somehow when you read it, that repetition really works. But there is a difference between balladry, obviously.
I think in balladry and a lot of the older traditional poetic forms, those repetitions were often there as a a sort of a memory framework, you know, to help you remember it, what was there. Because until books became a method of warehousing literature, you needed to draw these lines from memory all the time. And I think repetition does work in a slightly different way in music. I mean, sometimes to the point of hypnosis. I was thinking of a track like maybe Warm Leatherette, something like that by The Normal. There's just constant repetition of the same thing over and over again, but it becomes very trance-like. It becomes something that you want to keep going. You couldn't keep that up for 7 pages in a poetry book without your editor getting the blue pencil out.
Fun enough, because we spoke to Sparks a few weeks ago, and they're masters of this, because they write these very, very wordy, very arch, very ironic lyrics, but then occasionally they'll come up with something like, "My baby's taking me home," and it's just that repeated, repeated, repeated. But it's the fact of listening to him sing that again and again and again, and the meaning keeps changing, and you're kind of thinking, is this me or is this him? Or, you know, are we...
Or in Steely Dan's Showbiz Kids, when
Showbiz
Golda
Kids,
lost wages endlessly. But it just becomes trance-like behind these complex Donald Fagen lyrics underneath.
Yeah, no, and I think sometimes, especially with a band like Steely Dan, when the music is so complex, the really, you know, the really simple lines cut through. It sets them up, you know, it puts them on a tee.
So the question coming out of this would be, when you're writing... we needed to just clear something up. It's Lyre. That's how you pronounce it, right?
L-Y-R.
Yeah. You say L-Y-R.
Yeah, and actually...
Not Lear or Lear.
Well, that's what it sounds like in the mouths of several DJs. We had a bit of a tussle with the former record label because I wanted to insert full stops between each letter to make that clear, you know, in the way that REM would do originally. But I think they thought it might be a search problem on Spotify or, you know, Wikipedia or
I think it would read like a quite hip clothing company.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Or a drug.
So, yeah, we've been all of those pronunciations as you've articulated them there. But, yeah, we are L-Y-R, Land Yacht Regatta, is what the vicar would have to call
and
us.
And why Land Yacht Regatta? What is a Land Yacht Regatta? Is there such a thing? And why can't I say regatta?
That's easy for you to say, yeah.
Well, that's another good reason for abbreviation. I think it's completely unpronounceable. Well, I assume there is such a thing as a land yacht regatta. I mean, there are land yachts, and I assume when they get together, it's called a regatta, or it might be a rally or something like that. Yeah. We like the idea that, in some ways, it suggests a three-way contradiction. There are three of us in the band. We all live in different places in the UK. You know, we've got different backgrounds and upbringings and musical coordinates to a certain extent. So I was keen that we found, you know, a phrase that had three words in it that didn't seem to fit naturally together. You know, like Sheffield Ski Village or something like that.
Or that three-word find yourself.
Yeah, what three words? And actually, we've looked up Land Yacht Regatta in what three words, and it's a scrubby patch of land near a motorway in Uruguay.
Oh, my God. But how appropriate for your poetry.
Well, yeah, I think we need to go and play a show there.
Because I don't know if this is true. I don't know if I've just read something wrong, or because apparently the building that the Hacienda was in was formerly a yacht showroom, which just seems so oxymoronic for Manchester. And
yeah,
but what we have here is beautiful because it's Land Yacht Rock, right?
We're definitely not a rock yacht band. Yeah, I like the idea of people buying their super yachts very and good. Getting them on the ship canal.
Salford. Yeah. So, Simon, what I was going to get to was, do your lyrics for L-Y-R come after you've heard the music? Does the music inspire different words from you? Or do you have lyrics that you've written and when the right music arrives, you can find yourself just talking over the music?
Yeah, we've done it in every direction, really. I would say 70-80% of the time it starts with a lyric which I write and record and send as a sound file, and then either Patrick will pull together a composition around that or Richard will write a top-line melody. But we have done it the other way around. Richard's written a top-line melody sometimes and he's la-la'd it, and I've fitted words into the structure, and equally Patrick sometimes starts with a composition and he gives me an idea and I write something to fit it. We do quite a lot of commissioned work, and that tends to be lyric led, I would say. But yeah, there's no sort of formula really. It's definitely not the case of just trying to put music around poems. Yeah. And I think with this last album, we do feel as if it's a lot more integrated and coherent than the first one, where we were sort of working with, you know, bits and pieces of ideas, especially through COVID and having to do all that fairly remotely.
I'm sure some poems are certainly more concrete poems, are certainly there to be read and seen and not spoken. But for the poetry that is meant to be spoken out loud and often spoken by the writer, him or herself, there's always been a great musicality. You know, if we could dig back into, you know, Dylan Thomas and T.S. Eliot, and people that we can still hear read their poetry, Auden, there's a fantastic musicality in the voice, Yeats even.
I wanted to get to that because it's a good point, because having been immersed in your voice for the last day, which is a lovely thing, which is why I would say doing lyrics, doing poetry to music, it's kind of, your voice is an important part of that. And I was thinking, because if you listen to recordings of Yeats, he's quite foreboding. He's got a sort of certain darkness where you clearly have a reading voice.
Yeah, I think all poets have a reading voice. I mean, I tend to think of my own reading voice as being fairly deadpan. And I think I bring a sort of deadpan quality to the LYR project as well, to try and work as a counterbalance to Richard's voice, you know, which is incredibly beautiful, this falsetto noise that's very unexpected. But yeah, Yeats and people like Ezra Pound, you know, very theatrical voices, and I think they connected their poetry very much with a musical language. And I'm sure if you went back to the very origins of poetry, you know, around the campfire and in the temple and the theatres, music and poetry were probably almost the same thing. Mm-mm. You know, they hadn't become specialisms that happened separately and in their own right.
I think you adapt depending on if it's you're doing it to music or whether you're doing it solo, because I think when you do it to music, it is more deadpan, but when you're doing it on your own, I can hear you inflecting the pull and the push and the rhythms and some of the sonic qualities.
Yeah, that's right. And I think maybe that takes us back to the idea of working with the spaces and with silence and with absence, because what's happening in the background is nothingness, and you can tune into that with your voice and you can play with those silences and respond and react to them. One of the really exciting things with the band has been the opportunity these days to go back into the studio once all the track has been put together and re-record my vocal, my spoken part, with the music playing in my ear and reacting to those noises. Mm. And also taking the opportunity to be counterintuitive sometimes as well, because what I've noticed with Pat's compositions is that I'll send him something which I think is a bit angsty and angry and up tempo, and he will put it to something very very downbeat and low like, and vice versa. And you know, you don't always get to experiment with that kind of contradiction in poetry.
Yeah, there's a thing with your delivery. I was thinking, there's a poem I sent this to Gary last night, The Sperm Whale, which has got some hilarious, like absolutely hilarious, but it's all delivered kind of from the same place. And I see just one other thing on the music and poetry. I see when we're talking about listening to poets, you get someone like John Cooper Clarke, where you think his delivery is born of standing in front of a punk rock audience,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
And having to compete with that.
He honed his teeth, you know, going out on stage in front of an audience that was waiting for The Clash. Mm. And they'd be, you know, riotous. And the poets at that time, they were called ranters. And they had to hold their own in front of that audience, which must have been pretty nerve-wracking. But Johnny's got this incredible musicality, his ear for rhythm. Some very well-known poets, I'm sure, would die for that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for that ability, that intuition that he has.
How did LYR come about?
Richard came to an event that I was giving at King's Place in London. I think Richard had studied me for his A levels, so it tells you something about the about the age gap between us.
Yeah, that's a kind of stalking in the poetry world, isn't it?
Well, you know,
I actually found some of your poetry through looking up GCSE studies on the internet last night.
Yeah, I've been on the GCSE syllabus for for decades, and I still get a lot of people coming to readings, and they'll come up after to say, I did you for my GCSE, and I look at them and they are getting increasingly older. But yeah, he was interested in maybe using some of the poems as lyrics, and he did take a poem, a short poem called Redwoods, and set it to music. And then we started talking about whether there was a bit more in this project, and we got together with Patrick Pearson, who's multi-instrumentalist, producer, has a studio in Devon. And Richard sent me a dictaphone, quite an old-fashioned device with a big furry microphone cover. Oh. It just sat on my desk for about 2 years, making me feel guilty that I hadn't done anything. And then one day I had a bit of time and I pulled up some old files with these hybrid pieces I've written that I thought there was something in them, but they were a bit more performative. They weren't really page poems. And I tinkered with them a little bit and then sent them to Richard, and then he did something with them, and then they went off to Pat. And then, yeah, it all happened really quickly after that. Before I knew it, we were sitting in the Groucho Club or something, signing a contract. I knew it was getting serious when we got a manager and an agent, but I knew it was getting really serious when we got a lawyer. I thought, oh, this is big boy stuff now.
Who was your lawyer?
Well, I'm happy to be able to say, because we've never needed him, that I can't remember his name.
So. Okay, good.
There were some great tracks on that, because the first album, Calling the Crash Team, I particularly love Greatcoat. You know, it's an interesting one, because I'm assuming that it's about someone, it's like a father or someone who's not there anymore. That's how it reads to me. But on the other hand, I've always associated greatcoats with that sort of early 70s rock dress.
Rock fans.
And you mention a Zeppelin in it, so I'm drawing all these lines in my head. Fill me in.
You're my ideal reader or listener, Gary. That's what all poems and lyrics hope to do, that they suggest the particular and the specific. So I think you could read that as a relationship where somebody's talking about a father figure or a brother. But actually, you can put that coat on for a lot of situations, whether it's, you know, the older spectre of heavy rock that's sort of cast a shadow over your life, or any situation where you are dominated by someone or something else. It's a really important track for us, that, because it became something that we started playing live and then really began to crank it up. I think we ended up taking a lot of the live performances back into the studio for the next set of songs. And I know every time we finished playing that track, and it gets a bit shouty at the end in live performances, every time we finish it, I think I've got something off my chest there, but I'm not sure what.
Yeah, because it's kind of like it's just sort of like Superman's cape, isn't it, that greatcoat?
Yeah.
It's protective.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
And Calling the Crash Team itself, that lyric, it feels to me that in some songs you can chuck out tiny little glittery lines and morsels of ideas that maybe works in rock and roll but couldn't work in a poem that always has to have a deeper meaning. Is something in that?
Or slightly more specificity, as we were talking about earlier.
I think there have been times when I've been writing lyrics, either for my own projects or for other singer-songwriters, when I've been too wordy, you know, when I've been trying to, you know, develop characters or dialogue or narrative, and I forget that it's better to try and simplify, but not to the point where it becomes inane. I just mean, I think listeners to songs are just really interested in momentary details. You can go to a Radiohead concert and see, you know, 30,000 people singing about a plastic watering can. You know, I don't think it matters necessarily what the lyric's saying at that point. It's just about having a phrase to latch onto and identify with. And I try and concentrate on those little details in and amongst other bits of phrasing that just, you know, carry the rhythm or move the piece along slightly. In Greatcoat, I use the word fella. And I don't think that's a word that I would use in a poem. I don't think it's a word I would say, actually. It sounds a bit sort of Oasis when I try and say the word fella. but in the song, it seems to fit because, you know, I suppose I'm saying it as a character.
Mm-hmm. We should talk about the new album as well because we loved it, didn't we, Guy?
We did.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. Seriously.
Great, great tracks on the record. I mean, I don't really know where to start. I would like to start with Fishing Flies, actually, because I just thought that was... Now, just to say how I heard, here we are, you know, the first half of the song is about the sort of world of social media and the internet and the web and all the sort of profile and narcissism that we all live in. And then suddenly this person discovers putting fishing flies together, and then you just list what I think are the names of about, it feels like about 100 fishing flies, which are utterly beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous, yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I don't think any of us in the band have ever been fishing, let alone fly fishing. We've never tied a fly.
There goes the next question.
let me save you the bother.
You can only pull up carrots from a land yacht, surely.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a very profitable activity.
Shopping trolleys.
Throwing your line over the side onto the beach. Yeah, that's exactly what we were hoping to do with that track, that the first half is very manic. It's the description of somebody living in a world where they've been prompted and pushed all the time by, you know, the demands of the contemporary world and all its pressures. And then there's this sort of fulcrum moment in the track where both the lyric and the music sort of dissolve into something, I would say, much more beautiful, much more melodic. And it's an encouragement to slow down and to be more detailed and thoughtful and focused rather than scatterbrained. And the person in the song finds that in making these incredibly intricate, beautiful things, which, as you say, you know, have very beautiful names as well. It becomes a litany, somebody celebrating language and celebrating a slower pace of life. I mean, it's all guesswork and fiction, but I think implied in those names is just something very artful and meditative and contemplative.
Sorry to interrupt, but I did actually know, like, one of the absolute top writer producers in the world, right, back in the 80s. And his thing was he would literally finish work, go home, and he had a setup at home to make fishing flies.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what he did, yeah. Pat Leonard, that's what he did.
Yeah, I can imagine it being something that you could do actually even without going fishing. You know, just to make, they look like brooches.
Because they are beautiful. They're absolutely, exactly right. Yeah, or hat pins.
Yeah.
Yes, if you were Jack Hargreaves, you'd have them in your hat.
I suppose they've got quite a lethal use in the end.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because the beauty and how lethal they are at the same time.
Yeah, they're barbed. But we played that track live a few weeks ago for the first time, and it felt very satisfying, that moment where it sort of dissolved from the craziness of the first half into the harmonies and layers of the second half.
Are they all real names for fly?
Yeah, they're real flies, names.
They're
amazing.
Yeah. So what that gift
you
is...
You could just be saying that. No one will be any of the wiser.
Apart from Jack Hargreaves.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Turning in his grave. But the thing is, what you have there, what you've discovered and given us as a gift, is something that's in the dictionary. They're in some book. There are words. I mean, the same way that the poets love the names of birds or the names of the flowers in the hedgerows. And that's somewhere where your poetry generally hovers, isn't it? Between the tip and the heath.
It is, and between the everyday and the subconscious. And if we take that back to the fishing flies, I think the poem tries to exist both on the surface, where there's all these sort of reflections and shadows, but then the fishing flies is a way of getting under the surface, into the subconscious, into the depths. But yeah, I think the typical Armitage poem or lyric will have that combination of everyday sort of commonplace slang, vocabulary, and moments which are a bit more obviously poetic.
That's one of the lovely things about your poetry, which is, I think, is why you're the sort of right man at the right place. for, you know, for certainly to be the laureate, is that accessibility angle of it's like you can hear someone who, you know, clearly listened to the Smiths or whatever. You know, there's a real everydayness about it. You're not sort of teasing us with language.
I've always seen and thought of poetry as a form of communication, and if nobody understands it, you're not really, you know, communicating. I think if you're...
It doesn't bother Bob Dylan too much.
Well, you say that, but I think... But, I mean, apart from some of the real out-there moments, you know, like Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, yeah, where we're not quite sure what's going on, there's often a character and a storyline in Dylan. I did one of my Oxford lectures on Hattie Carroll, you know, where he's talking about the woman being killed in the Baltimore hotel by William Zantzinger after he'd hit her with a cane. And, you know, it comes from a newspaper report, so he's sort of poeticized a very sort of prosaic description of something and made it very... He's found the sort of inner story in that. Yeah. What were we talking about?
I was being flippant, obviously.
Yeah, you just said the wrong thing there, Guy.
That was the wrong thing.
Simon did a lecture at Oxford about this subject you're teasing him with.
Yeah, I'll get me a coat.
Your great coat.
Oh, very good.
Anyway, no, carry on, Simon, sorry.
I can't remember what we were talking about.
Well,
actually.
Yeah, you know, that idea of singing about, news.
Well, somebody once said that if you're a poet who's shallow and inane and mundane, then, you know, you're misusing poetry. But if you're obscure and incredibly difficult and beyond anybody's register, then you're sort of misusing language. And I just try and find that middle ground. I think poetry is an incredibly, as I said before, powerful tool. But you've got to welcome people. You've got to meet people halfway. You can't just be doing your own thing, otherwise you know, you won't have any readers.
But in that sense, how autobiographical are your words? You know, if you think of someone, I always think of Ted Hughes as being someone who isn't autobiographical. Is sitting outside of and looking into nature, where, you know, someone like Larkin is much more, you know, telling us about his own. It's a psychoanalysis issue.
Yeah, Larkin was very, you know, sociological poet. He wrote poems very much of the time and of the era, you know, full of brand names and cars of the times he lived in. I did a series on Larkin last year, looking at a lot of the poems, because it would have been Larkin's 100th birthday last year, and I was wondering how they stand up so many years after they were published, because they, you know, they seem located in a very particular time and space. Hughes, I think, had more, I was going to say psychological, but I think maybe cosmological concerns. There definitely are biographical poems in there, especially when he published Birthday Letters at the end, which was all about his relationship with Sylvia Plath. I think poets know that if you use, you know, the first person, if you say I in a poem, that people will presume it's you, and you can have a lot of fun with that. I always say to students, you know, you're not trying to write diary entries here. You're trying to make a work of art. You know, there are times when you've got to go off-piste from the truth, because the truth might be very boring. That's not to say that the poem has to be a lie. I think the important thing is that it has to have the ring of truth, because you're trying to articulate an idea rather than just say something about yourself.
I just want to have a sidebar on Larkin, and then we'll have Ted Hughes, because I was fortunate enough to see Larkin's office. I gave a talk up at Hull University a few years ago, and I was invited into his office, which he had designed.
So
the wallpaper, you must have been there, right?
Yeah.
So the wallpaper, all that 1950s stripe wallpaper, beautiful, his desk immaculate, it's still the same. And the person there said, you know, would you sign the visitor's book? And Larkin had actually written the visitor's book out. He had tooled the lines and the visitor, he'd written visitor and date and comment.
Wow.
And I signed it. And literally 2 pages before my name was the Queen Mother opening in the 1950s. So I'm guessing not many visitors.
Oh, brilliant.
I think, it's still technically that room, one of the office spaces for the actual library at Hull University. But, you know, he was very senior there, and he chose his own space. And as an office, it overlooks the entrance to the library, so he could sort of keep an eye on who was coming and going. But you're right, it's like his poems. It's very much of its time. I think there might be a gas fire
functional
in the corner.
Yeah,
and very tidy. Did you try on his glasses? Because his glasses are on his desk. I put them on. It's like they're like made out of aquarium glass or something, about 3 inches thick.
I saw them. I didn't put them on, though.
I just wanted to stick with Ted Hughes for a second,
yeah,
because you're such a Bowie fan as a kid. Mm. And the whole thing was that Bowie represented this sort of otherness, as to all of us, you know, this guy from outer space and everything. Whereas when you heard Ted Hughes, and Ted Hughes was from the next village.
Yeah.
And I love this idea that somehow Ted Hughes, who I'd say in terms of language was, you know, just as otherworldly as Bowie or anything, but I wanted the idea of that poet being from the next village that made poetry seem attainable. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think attainable, and also it gave me a kind of permission to write, both in terms of the subject matter. You know, I recognised so clearly from those early books of his, which he was writing about, you know, Hebden Bridge and Calder Valley and Mytham Road, all those places. I knew the topography of those poems. I knew the language. I knew the people. But also, yeah, just that feeling of, well, you know, he grew up in a terraced house on the side of a hill in West Yorkshire, and mm-hmm. he could do it. Why can't I do it? Mm-hmm. And speaking about Bowie in the same paragraph, in a completely different way, Bowie was also a permission giver for me. With him, it was about, it's okay to be different, you know, to be alternative. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a small, traditional, working-class, old mill village. I was the village punk. I was the village mod. I was the village new romantic. You know, I, every time a new trend came along, I ransacked my sister's wardrobe to see what I could adapt. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that...
Would you be the only one in the village?
There were a couple of us. So, you know, I wasn't right out there on my own, but it was tough going. But people like Bowie, who I think actually I think I'd confused him with Jesus when I was younger, because
easily,
you know,
done.
he was always talking about being in space and up there in the heavens, and I think I'd mixed the two people up. But I've got a poem where I write about listening to, you know, those lines, blue, blue, electric blue, that's the colour of my room, mm-hmm. and pale blinds drawn all day. Listening to those in a youth club in Marsden, I talk about how he'd probably scribbled them on a groupie's buttock with an eyeliner pencil or something, but they'd made it all in Berlin, but they'd made it all the way back to this little youth club in an old mill in a village on the side of the hill. And mm-hmm. you know, it was like receiving a message from a time capsule heading out into the universe.
And of course, the spiders were from Hull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of
course.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, or you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the rock on tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. That's drinkag1.com/rockonteurs. Check it out. You wrote a book, Gig, which was about your sort of wanting to be a rock star and how this persona kind of took over your life. We all know that. We all know how that feels, you know. I mean, it's, in fact, there's a... your latest book of 15 poems, which is sort of you just talking to your soul that's nagging away at you, in a way is a kind of like a rock star's persona. I mean, I'm feeding this into thinking about Bowie as well and creating this other person that you might want to be. Just talk to us a bit about those early days of wanting to be a rock star. I laugh. I shouldn't be laughing. We all wanted to be rock stars.
Well, you guys achieved it. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny, actually. I can think about, you know, watching Top of the Pops. What would I have been? Sort of 17, 18, seeing Spandau on there doing, to cut a long story short, was Tony Hadley wearing, I think he was wearing a sporran, if I remember. And
No, that was Steve. Yeah, he may have been, actually. I think it was Steve Norman was or something. Yeah, yeah.
And, right, and there were a lot of spats.
You shared it around, didn't you?
You only had the one. Jodhpurs going on. The band, yeah, sporran. But yeah, I think I just wanted to express myself and wasn't sure how I wanted to do that. In that book that you talk about, Gig, The Life and Times of a Rockstar Fantasist, I'm trying to test the theory that I'd sort of fallen into poetry because, you know, being in a band hadn't really worked out. I think I disproved that theory in the end, but by and large, it was just all to do with how do I tell the world what it feels like to be me? How do I tell the world what the world looks like to me? And I probably knew I wanted to do that from somewhere slightly off stage or back a little bit. You know, poetry became a way of doing that, because you can do it via the books, you can do it through text. In some ways, that, you know, it's come full circle now. But at the end of the day, with LYR, I just stand there and talk, and I don't make myself vulnerable by singing. In fact, we had a lot of arguments to begin with when, you know, the spectre of the live performances came up about who was actually going to stand in the middle. And like, I'm not the front man here, but you know, that's where I ended up. But I still think that it's not quite the same thing. I feel as if I'm still able to do, you know, this sort of expression, but at a slight distance in the band.
I just want to sort of jump back from what you were saying here about this thing of needing to express yourself, putting out, and then wanting to write poetry and everything like that. So you go to uni and do geography. English lits, perhaps, or, you know.
Yeah, I just wasn't thinking straight, Guy. I didn't have the map in front of me. I didn't have a lot of options at the time, to be absolutely honest. I was a really poor student back then and was very unfocused. I was very contrary. If somebody said, do this, I went and did the opposite. And I think it would have been a disaster, actually, if I'd have gone off and studied English literature, because people would have been saying, read this book, and I would have been doing something else. And in fact, that's what happened with the geography degree. I was interested in geography. I wanted to be a geographer. But I went off to Portsmouth Poly and did a geography degree, and all the time I was reading poetry books in the library because, you know, I was misbehaving and doing what I shouldn't be, and I thought that was alternative and subversive, and yeah, so it was the right thing. And actually, the books are full of geography. They're full of landscape and travel.
Yeah. You were a probation officer for a bit. Someone told us there's an interesting story about a windmill. Does that ring a bell?
About a windmill.
Who told
Let
us
me
this?
Think. Oh yeah, actually, this is a story. Oh. Yeah, this is a story that I feel like somebody on Graham Norton, where they have to be nudged towards the, you know, the, what they've told the researchers.
Actually, I felt a bit like that asking the question.
That thing with the donkey. Oh yeah, that thing. Actually, it was something that a friend told me, but it's very sort of probation officer like. He told me that he'd been a youth worker up in Newcastle, and one day he was driving along the road. And he saw one of the lads that he did some work with, so he stopped and to give him a list. And they were driving through some part of Newcastle, and there's a windmill there. And I'm not going to do a Geordie accent, by the way, but the lad said, "What's that over there?" And my friend said, it's a windmill." And he said, "Well, what's one of them?" And he said, "Well, it, you know, the wind blows and the sails turn round and it grinds the corn." He said, "Well, how does it do that?" And he said, "Well, there's two big stones, and you know, they used to put the grain in, and when the wind blows, it's on an axle and it comes around, turns the stones and it crushes the grain, and it crushes and crushes and crushes it, and what comes out at the bottom is flour that you make bread with." And this lad looked at him for 5 minutes and he said, "Fuck off."
Oh, actually, as a little thing, jump back, that when I found out that you'd been a probation officer, for some reason, I don't know why, I saw a slight parallel with Ian Curtis. Because he had some similar, I think maybe it was just the benefits office, but I just wondered if there was some slightly sort of dour civil service-y, although dealing with people and troubled people, and for sort of a, if that was something poetic in that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I was working in Manchester at the time.
And he was Macclesfield, wasn't he?
So. He was Macclesfield, yeah, but, you know, they became known as a Manchester band. Mm. And I'm sure Manchester people will forgive me for saying that it was a pretty grim time in that city. It felt
Oh,
very,
man, it was hardcore in the 80s, yeah, it was. Yeah.
It felt very black and white. And I think my connection with, you know, Curtis and Joy Division was that I'd sort of tapped into music just at the end of the punk era. And, you know, the various other things that were around. But I just got to that age where I was looking for something a bit more, you know, a bit deeper, a bit more thoughtful. And then those post-punk bands came along at just the right time. So, you know, 79 was a big year for me musically. So that'd be Unknown Pleasures, and it would be Fear of Music, and it would be Three Imaginary Boys. And there were a lot of other things going on then. You know, I think that was the same year that The Wall came out, and Off the Wall, and
God, there was a lot of wall-related stuff.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah,
it's going off in all directions. But, and I guess as somebody who was sort of thinking about poetry then, and inner landscapes, and expression, that music couldn't have come quick enough at the time. You know, that quite melancholy, introspective noise that. I also remember that it was the next year was when all the electronic music started hitting the scene. There was a club in Huddersfield called Flicks, which played, you know, Soft Cell, and
there was always a club.
Yeah,
wherever you went, there was always a club.
I remember going in there one night. I think maybe the first time I went in, and going up to the DJ booth and asking him for the B-52s, and he leant over and he said to me, "We don't play songs with guitars in."
Ah. Wow, wow. Because there was a kind of electro police at the time, wasn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We have to talk about you being a poet laureate, how that felt, the weight of that, you know, following in the footsteps of Wordsworth, Tennyson, you know, great poet laureates from before. Does it make you nervous knowing what you need to do, what the job is at hand and the task?
I think it's a little bit of a, you know, don't look down situation. You could get vertiginous if you saw it that way, and there are these big dinosaur footprints in front of you that you could easily stumble into. But most days I'm just like everybody else, you know, I get up and try and take the top off the Marmite jar. It's a regular existence, and I think living up here keeps me to some extent grounded. You know, I still live by and large amongst people I grew up with, and I can't really commit, as they say, up here. Mm-hmm. But it's a tradition that, yeah, I'm very aware of. I take the job very seriously. I try and do it to the best of my ability, but I also try and do it as me. with the poems I write. I just assume that they asked me to do it because of the work that I've written, and I want to carry on writing those same poems. It was, you know, incredibly, I think moving is the right word. You know, I remember I was living in the States when they got in touch with me and said, would you become the next
was
laureate?
Was it Princeton where you were?
Yeah, I was teaching at Princeton. I was actually in Washington that day doing something at the university, and got this phone call. I had a long call, and then I phoned my dad, because my dad had been a probation officer as well, and he was always a bit worried that I'd given up a profession to do this thing called poetry, where, you know, where there were no guarantees of income and so on and so forth. He thought it was a bit shady. And I rang him up and I said, you know, I've got something to tell you, and I'll need to do it fairly quick because this call's costing a lot of money. You know, it's transatlantic. So I said, you know, I'm going to be the next poet laureate. And then I could hear him crying, and I could hear my mum coming in from the kitchen with a tea towel for him to wipe his eyes. And then he said, if your granddad had been alive today, this would have killed him. but it, in some ways, it was like the phone call that I always wanted to make, because I just wanted to say to him, look, it sort of worked out. You know, it's worked out in the end. But
well, I was just wondering if your dad would have given you a proper bluff Yorkshire response, which is like, what are the hours?
Yeah, what the pay? Yeah, what's the pay? It nearly killed him because he had to keep it quiet for 3 months before the press announcement. And he, you know, he wasn't a man who was given to keeping things quiet.
I think you have a great skill as the poet laureate, because, you know, obviously you have to write about grand things. Like, you know, one poem that comes to mind that you wrote is Patriarchs. I think it's called Patriarchs. Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah.
About the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. Mm. And you somehow don't just focus on him, although there's plenty of very specific biographical stuff about him in there, but you focus on that generation,
yeah,
which includes a lot of men that we see as our heroes, which fought fascism.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you're consciously bringing it down to every man, aren't you?
You have to find a way into a poem. You have to find an angle. And with all the poems I've written, you know, for royal events, I've always thought, well, there's enough pomp and circumstance going on anyway without me having to add to it. I just need to find another track. And I've always started by thinking nobody wants a bad poem writing about them. Presumably, they want something that they could consider to be art and artful. It's difficult to write a poem about, you know, somebody that you didn't know. And also, you know, Prince Philip was, you know, let's say a character. So there were, colourful. Colourful. There were lots of things to consider. But you're right. I decided to write about his generation, and there are lots of details in that poem which apply to his past and his life. But
the orange box, for example.
Yeah. In terms of it being an elegy, I was probably also writing about my dad, who died 3 weeks earlier. So there was some sort of grieving elements, personal grieving elements for me. I think I was writing about a lot of people's dads, you know, and it comes back to that idea of trying to make the poem universal. And when I wrote a poem for the coronation, I decided to follow up that news story that it was going to be a people's event. They were going to invite a lot of people to Westminster Abbey that day who were, not my phrase, but ordinary people who'd done things in their lives which were thought I was, you know, doing good turns. And I just sort of described a day in the life of somebody who'd set off on the train and gone to this incredibly rich occasion and then was back home by tea time watching it again on the telly.
Yeah, because it's this incredible balancing act, I would think. I don't know if it feels like this to you, of which I think you do very well, of as the laureate, it's that thing of having to speak to and for the country.
It is sort of impossible. But having said that, that's how I think of poetry. I think of it as an impossibility. I've always taken the approach that the idea is the puzzle and the poem is the solution. And I like the now get out of that, you know, situation of some poems. When I was appointed, it was pointed out to me that, you know, during the next 10 years, there probably would be some quite momentous royal occasions. I don't think they'd quite anticipated what they would all be. But, most of those have already happened. And I think if I'd have started thinking then about how I could tackle them poetically, I would have been a bit of a nervous wreck. But as they've come along, there's always a sort of situation or some kind of scene that you can light on as a writer, finding the poetry in a particular occasion.
I just wanted to just read it. Well, I'm going to read. Guy, you'll like this though, because in Simon's latest book, LX15, he says, "But I got to visit some fancy places and eavesdropped a thing or two among thrones and crowns. What did she say that time at the palace? I think it's marvellous what you do, seeing things and writing them down."
Well, you know what? You know what? When I was appointed laureate, I decided that, you know, because, you know, I do have some official duties and have to go along to the palace and have conversations. And I decided that I wasn't going to be one of those people that had an audience with the Queen or the King and then came out immediately and told everybody, you know, what they'd said. I just thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to keep my own counsel. But from that quote, what happened that day was that I was taking another poet, David Constantine, along to the palace. I run a committee which makes recommendations for what is now the King's Gold Medal for Poetry. And every year somebody is selected and I take them along to the palace and they receive their medal from the sovereign. So this particular year, it was David Constantine, and we were going along to the palace, but it was during the COVID, you know, I can't remember which one of the lockdowns, COVID scares, but we were told that we should still go to the palace, but she wasn't going to be there. She was going to be at Windsor Castle. And so we went into a room, and instead of it being the Queen, it was the Queen on a telly, on a live link from Windsor. And, you know, because it's the palace, it wasn't some swanky flat screen. You know, it was like some old Grundig. The vertical hold wasn't all it could have been. Yeah, so it was just this odd occasion, sort of bowing to a TV screen and then having the conversation. But those conversations are always fascinating and private. But at the end, as a way of concluding the conversation, she did say, "I think it's marvellous what you do, seeing things and writing them down." Yeah. I felt in the fact that she'd said seeing things and writing them down gave me permission to see that and write it down. But I also came away thinking, actually, that's exactly what we do. I put that on my CV.
Yeah, completely.
Well, I'd like to spend with Gary, if you don't mind, Simon, I just want to share something that Gary said to me about 25 years ago. We actually wrote a musical together about Yeats and More Gone, and we used to discuss poetry a lot. And Gary said something which has always stayed with me as one of my favourite descriptions of poetry, which he said, "You remember when you're first in love, and as you go through your day, everything you see is significant and related. Oh my God, the number six, she went to the number six. Oh my God, that's and everything is related and significant and heightened and related to that person." And Gary, you said, "The job of the poet is to see the world like that all the time."
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true at the time of writing. You are trying to amplify or to catch that amplification that you feel. And that's why you can't write poetry all the time, because you just can't be in that mood. You know, you're not in love like that all the time. You're not experiencing the ecstasy of it every second.
Or the agony.
All the agony. Yeah. But I think that's a very useful description. It does suggest that... No, I was going to say something that I would have come to repent at leisure.
Okay. Going back to the new album, which is, as we said, we love the Ultraviolet Age. Hockney Red really rang a bell with me, because I remember as a kid going into my mum's bedroom, and she had a little dressing table with three mirrors, you know, a little triptych of mirrors. And in front she had I remember there was her makeup. And then, okay, Guy, you know, you're going to love all this story, right? But, you know, and she had a little jewellery box. And when you were lifted up the jewellery box, there was a ballerina that went around and some music played. And I remember distinctly trying on the lipstick in front of the mirror. And it was something I'd do. And I think it was trying to bond with my mum. It was trying to sort of see what her secrets were, but at the same time be enamoured by them. And that's exactly what Hockney Red is about, isn't it, on your latest album?
Be enamoured by them, even. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can see why I got the job, can't you?
Because yours is about nail polish, isn't it? Nail paint.
What you're describing there Gary, you could be describing my exact experience. My mum had the same dressing table with the three mirrors. She's still got it, in fact, in her bedroom at home. And, you know, you were asking about whether or not pieces of writing are biographical. It's written generally, but I did exactly the same thing. I went in there, I got the nail polish out, I tried it on. It was, I hadn't thought about it as identification with my mum, but there was experimentation going on there. There was a Bowie moment for me, and I was thinking that everybody's done this. And at the end of that track, there's a line, "I'm not really a waitress," which is actually the name of a nail polish by, I think it's OPC. It's one of their shade names, which is fantastic. It's a fantastic name for a nail polish. And actually, I wanted to call that track "I'm Not Really a Waitress." And actually, I think I wanted to call the album "I'm Not Really a Waitress," but we lost our nerve. That's exactly what that track is describing. That,
okay, well, I never did that. Now I feel like the weird one.
Yeah.
I was very young.
Yeah. I was very young. I wasn't even prepubescent. I was very young. But I remember the lipstick smelling of my mother, and it was a way of finding some closeness and intimacy.
My mum also had the trinket box that when you opened it, the ballerina came up and it played the Nutcracker Suite.
But I remember those. I remember from relatives having that. But also the triptych, that was an absolute, and I think it was across pretty much every strata of society, was that dressing table. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in the house, that was my mum's area. You know, that was her little corner. It was sort of private to her. She kept her things in that room, in that corner of the bedroom. So it was like an altar. Now I come to think about it.
That's exactly what it is.
Something
exactly
a little bit sacred about it.
Yeah. Simon, thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
This has been an absolute joy. I feel lifted up.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Bettered.
Go off and write a poem, Guy.
Well, I've seen things. I'm going to write them down, Simon.
Actually, about 5 minutes ago, I was just going to say, have we started yet?
Good luck with the record. You're going out playing live. Do you want to plug that?
Yes, we've got a tour in end of September, beginning of October, starting at the Howard Assembly Rooms in Leeds. I think that's something like the 27th, 28th or 29th of September, and then off to the Deaf Institute in Manchester the night after. That's the last Sunday in September. And then we've got about 7 or 8 other gigs dotted around. It's all on our Instagram page, website, etc., etc.
London?
Yeah. Hoxteth Hall, is it called?
Can I come along to that? Can we come
along?
We'd
love you to come along. Yes, please. Yeah. We'll get a little VIP area set up.
We bring our own velvet rope.
Yeah, I was going to say, Gary always, when he was saying there's always a club, by the way, that was the thing, because whenever Gary travels, he always has his own velvet rope with him.
You can only come in if you bring the sporran.
I think it's Tony Hadley's turn, I'm afraid.
Yeah, we'd love to see you there. Yep.
Good luck. Brilliant.
So lovely to meet you, Simon. Thank you so, so much. Talking
pleasure.
To you.
Take care.
Total pleasure. All the best.
Bye.
All the best.
Ah,
I could have done that all day. All day.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Just wonderful.
And it was rock and roll enough for the raconteurs, I think, wasn't it?
No, I think it absolutely was. And I think that's the point. I think what's so nice is that's why he should be the poet laureate, because he comes from that place that everyone does, you know, and he speaks a language that everyone understands. And that comes from having had rock and roll in this country.
I guess it's harder in this horrid time of culture wars, because there must be, you know, I noticed he'd written a poem for the BBC, you know, and how great that institution is, you know. And of course, we all know, you know, the world seems divided at the moment for and against.
Also, I think it's a very common, which is why he makes the point, and I think it's absolutely right, the poetry forms like that are actually more needed than ever. It's a step back from our endless feeds, you know, slow down.
Right, I'm going off to make some fishing flies. Well, do something with my flies.
I'm going to go and fish around my flies.
Exactly. We have some extras, which you can discover if you sign up to the extras page on raconteurs.com. That's the sort of housekeeping we have to do to tell you that.
Yeah, we get in trouble.
Also, because we want you to go to get the extras because they're great.
We're enjoying doing it. And oh my God, that was great. I'm going to go and listen to some, read some poetry.
Just to say, those albums are so lovely to listen to. And also, I've just had on the audiobooks of him reading his own poetry. And his voice is just such a joy to listen to.
But does it compare with Banana Blush?
Don't you find some of the backing on that is a little raucous?
I don't think our listeners know what Banana Blush is.
I'm sure they all know what. Our audience is sophisticated enough. Yes, it's a load of classical type arrangements written with John Betjeman, who was a poet laureate as well, reading his poems over him.
You turned me onto it.
I did turn you onto it. I think it came out in like 1977. Like we'd have been listening to it then.
Yeah. But now I've got the vinyl.
Of course you have.
It's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rockanteurs is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.